Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
Are you chairing for the first bill?
Yes.
Okay, so this. You guys don't like me to have a gavel.
I started though, right?
Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is March 14, 2013. First item on the agenda is Senate File 827. I'm the chief author of it, so I'll ask Senator Goodwin to come and chair the meeting.
Senate sure. File 827, Senator Latz's bill is a revisor's bill. Senator Latz, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have with me Janet Rahm from the revisor's office who will present the annual revisor's bill.
Thank you, Ms. Rahm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Rahm, deputy of revisor from the revisor of statutes office. I'm here today for Michelle Timmons, the reviser, who is out of the office receiving an award, the Finnegan Freedom of Information Award, for the work that she's done on our website.
Oh, congratulations to Ms. Timmons.
You have an amendment.
Sure. Madam Chair, we have an author's amendment. It's the 813-118 amendment. Move adoption of the amendment.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Go ahead with your bill, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think we should probably note we have had enough members check in so that we have a quorum.
We did have enough members check in?
Yes, I have seen
yes.
at least a quorum already present in the room.
Okay, great. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Latz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, you know, the revisor's bill is an annual bill that clarifies and corrects statutes and administrative rules. There's no policy in the revisor's bill. It's technical clarifications, errors, as long as the correction's not controversial. So that's the goal. But every year we have to do that just to make sure we've got the statutes looking the way they should. So, Ms. Rahm?
Ms. Rahm?
The bill this year is almost entirely made up of correcting errors and cross-references, either references to statutes that have been repealed or to statutes that were moved or reenacted or recodified, and then we needed to replace with the correct reference. There's also several sections that change names when names have been changed of offices. We've got a few sections where we have resolved conflicts where statutes have not been able to be merged. In those cases, we've always worked with the departments and the Senate Council, House Research, and other staff to be sure that everyone agrees that we are making the correct correction.
Thank you, Ms. Rahm. The revisor's bill is normally a non-controversial bill that just does exactly that and corrects statutes. So are there any questions from members? Seeing none.
Chair, I'll move Senate File 827 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Okay, Senate File 827 is with amendments is recommended to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Madam Chair.
Next bill up is Senator Sharon's. This is Senate File 1014.
Good afternoon, Senator Latz. I have an amendment to the bill. Do you want us to make that amendment at this time? And then we'll go through, because it really substantially changes the original bill. It changes almost all of Article 2. And then we will go through the entire bill with the amendment, if you agree to this.
Sure, Senator Sharon, that's fine, but this is not the bill's first stop, right? So
that's correct.
If you can give us a summary of the amendment before we adopt it.
The amendment changes Article 2 and really addresses the process through which a person, through which the court determines whether a person is civilly committed or whether or not they move. And then once they're civilly committed, what is the placement that the person has based on the needs for safety and for the proper treatment perspective. And then there's also within the amendment language that deals with how a person progresses through their treatment process. And then also up within the language is language related to how an individual can have their treatment and progression reviewed by the court.
All right. Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A3 amendment. Is there any discussion of that? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I have with me today former Chief Justice Eric Magnuson and our Commissioner Cindy Jessen. I've asked each of them to speak to why it is that we are in front of you today and some of the critical elements of this bill. So with your permission, I will. I think that that would be helpful to the committee in terms of understanding the context and the basis for the language that is in the bill in front of you. So with that, with your permission, I would ask former Chief Justice Eric Magnuson, or I think that's the best way, to address the committee.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, before you begin, I think we should note that this bill is a product of a lot of work and deliberation behind the scenes and publicly. On a bipartisan basis, I understand Senator Hahn is also a co-author on this bill. Is that right, Senator Sharon?
Yes. Yes, and thank you for mentioning that. I should give credit to also Senator Limmer, who has worked on this task force out of which some of these recommendations have been coming. Senator Lori's worked on the task force that Judge Magnuson will talk about. And they are members, along with Senator Hahn and Senator Berglund earlier, that have worked a long time to be responsive to a series of reviews of our civil commitment process and our treatment program for sex offenders for a lot of reasons, from whether or not the process is appropriate to whether or not we can find a way to address this growing population at a more cost-effective way without challenging the public safety. So this is a process that's been going on more than just this year, and we've had many many players on a bipartisan basis trying to address a problem that we all recognize needs to be addressed.
Chief Justice Magnuson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, it's a pleasure to be here. You have a number of materials that have been provided to you. For the past 6 months or so, I have been chairing a task force appointed by the United States District Court for the District of Minnesota. My vice chair is former chief judge of that court, James Rosenbaum. The task force consists of a large number of individuals, judges, legislators, lawyers who represent both sides of the civil commitment process, and mental health care providers. I hope to give you just a brief overview of how we came to be appointed and what it is we're trying to do. Minnesota is one of 20 states in the country that civilly commits sex offenders after they have served their criminal sentence. Minnesota has the highest commitment rate per capita of any state in the country. Minnesota also has the fewest releases from commitment of any state in the country. In fact, over the past decade, exactly one. Persons civilly committed as sexually dangerous persons or sexually psychopathic personalities, as I said, have already served their criminal sentence. Under the Constitution, You can't incarcerate someone because you're afraid of what they might do in the future. You can commit individuals, however, who suffer from an illness and who present a danger to the public in order to treat them. The Constitution requires that persons civilly committed receive meaningful treatment and that their commitment last only so long as required by their condition. Now, as I mentioned, there is a federal lawsuit pending in the district court for the District of Minnesota. It is a class action. It started off with the prisoners representing themselves, but the judge thought that there was enough merit to the case to appoint counsel to represent them, and they now have extremely competent and effective representation. Their basic argument is no one ever gets out of civil commitment in Minnesota. It's a one-way street. It's a life sentence. And if the linchpin of the constitutional validity of civil commitment is effective treatment, almost by definition, if no one ever gets out, the treatment cannot be effective. The federal court has the power to declare the civil commitment system unconstitutional. That has happened in other states. We have a very comprehensive website for our task force. If you were to Google Minnesota Sex Offender Task Force, you would be taken to it. And among other things, we have summaries of the laws of Minnesota. We have comparisons of those laws to the laws of other states. And we have the pleadings and decision from the Washington Federal Court, which declared its system of civil commitment unconstitutional. When federal courts declare state systems unconstitutional, they do it with a broadsword. They do not do it with a scalpel. They do not take over the system and micromanage it. They impose sanctions. And so if you're familiar at all with the school desegregation litigation that went on for so long in, for example, the state of Missouri and the state of Kansas, you'll know what a protracted and expensive process that was for the state. In California, when there was a challenge to the constitutionality of the conditions in their prisons, and a federal court found them to be unconstitutional, the court imposed sanctions and ultimately ordered the release of a number of prisoners because they could not be held in unconstitutional circumstances. The problems with the Minnesota sex offender program are not new. In 2005, then-Governor Tim Pawlenty appointed a commission to review the system and to make recommendations for how it might be improved and to identify problems with it. We have that report on our website. In 2011, the Office of the Legislative Auditor conducted a comprehensive review of the system and found numerous significant defects. You have the summary of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. It's these problems that form the basis, in part, for the federal litigation. It is evidence that the state itself has created of the problems with its system. Now, the task force that I chair was appointed by the federal court to make specific recommendations on three areas of the civil commitment program, basically how people get in, what happens to them when they're there, and how they might leave the program. The court specifically directed us to make recommendations by the first part of December on that middle issue, on how you can create, what remedies you can create to make sure that people who are committed can move through the process and receive the treatment that they need. We did that. You have a copy of our report. It recites some of the background information. It relates some of the conclusions that we reached, and it makes 14 specific recommendations. This legislation is a significant step towards addressing the issues identified by the prior studies and by our task force. Simply stated, there is urgency in acting on these issues now. I think the federal court has given a clear signal that it is very concerned about the status of the system. It's a very unusual step to appoint a task force, but I think it is the judge's way of giving the state a chance to fix its own problems, to fix them in a way that is comprehensive, to fix them in a way that is sensible and serves the interests of the state best. And so I would urge you to favorably consider this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Justice Magnuson. Are there any questions specifically for Justice Magnuson at this time? All right, Senator Sharon, would you like Commissioner Jessen to?
Please.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. First of all, I do want to thank Justice Magnuson and Judge Rosenbaum for chairing and vice-chairing this task force, Senator Sharon for bringing forth this legislation, and Senator Limmer for serving on the task force. I know that these issues are not new, but I do think that there is kind of a heightened urgency to deal with them. And I think that the two main issues that I do want to talk about that are in this bill really start taking steps forward, steps that have been recommended, as Justice Magnuson was saying, since really 2005, and starts us down a better path. But before making comments on those two provisions, I do just want to be clear about what the bill does not do. This bill does not change any of the criteria for civil commitment. So when a judge is deciding whether to civilly commit someone as a sexually dangerous person, it doesn't change the rules on that. And the bill doesn't change the standards for provisional discharge. It doesn't make it doesn't ease those or lighten those standards. But the bill does make changes in two kind of important procedures, which I think are two steps towards reform and two steps also to address the concerns of the federal court, which I think we need to do with some urgency. So let me just maybe briefly describe why I think those two steps are important. And the first is the procedure is bifurcation of the civil commitment process for sex offenders. Right now, when a judge has to determine whether an individual should be civilly committed, applying the standards the legislature has in place, they have to make a decision about whether to civilly commit them and send them to Moose Lake, which is a very expensive, highly secure facility, or whether or not to commit them at all. It's really very much an either-or decision. And what this legislation proposes is to bifurcate that decision. First of all, have the judge, using the criteria they've used for years, decide whether someone should be civilly committed as a sexually dangerous person or a psychopathic personality. And then once that decision is made, then have a second session to decide, well, then where should that person go? Should that person go to Moose Lake, which is still very much an option under this proposal, or is there a little less, a different alternative, an alternative which would still protect the public safety and provide treatment, but is not the same as being behind the razor wire at Moose Lake. But to do this at the department, we thought you all need to know what those options might be. It's hard to look at those and say, yes, we should look at alternatives, which is what the task force is recommending, without knowing how much would they cost, what kind of treatment would be there. Are there providers out there willing to do this? Where are they? So in early January, the department issued an RFI, Request for Information, and we sent it to providers all around our state, including our own state-operated services, as well as providers around the country, and said, tell us what you would propose to be on these alternative placements. Tell us what kind of security you would have. Tell us what kind of treatment you would have to care for perhaps some of these civilly committed individuals. Tell us how much it would cost. And we've collected that information. We heard from 21 different providers, which cover all parts of our state, about what that could look like. We just received that within the last week and a half. We're summarizing it, and it'll be available to you because I think that it is important to know before taking a step of saying let's create a little more of a continuum for people without knowing what that might look like and how much that would cost. The second recommendation, which I think is really a step forward, is also consistent with the recommendation from the Office of Legislative Auditor, and that's the addition of external regular reviews of clients at MSOP. It doesn't change the criteria for provisionally discharging them in any way, but what it means is there would be regular assessments of each of these individuals and that those assessments would be provided to the courts. The system now is courts decide who comes in, courts decide who goes out. This wouldn't change that, but it would mean that that clients got regular reviews and that information was available to the courts so they could make better informed decisions and determine whether the individual has made enough progress in treatment that they meet the criteria the legislature has set forward for provisional discharge. You know, I certainly understand and appreciate the political nature of revising any sort of policy relating to this population, which is why I so appreciate the bipartisan support that this has received in the Senate. I would say, as based upon my experience, I think these are appropriate measures, but may I say, measured steps, which will help protect our program so it can continue, do more to protect clients in it, and protect public safety. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there any questions specifically for Commissioner Jessen at this time?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, as I have studied the Minnesota Sexual Offender Program, the civil commitment aspect of it, we began to raise questions about that, not just this year, but starting about 2 years ago. And what was kind of unusual was, and just for the benefit of discussion, we brought a group of legislators to some of the facilities, the one in St. Peter and the one at Moose Lake. But what was really telling was that when we visited the St. Peter facility, we were told by staff, first they welcomed us, they sat us down, showed us everything we wanted to see. And while we were there, they said, we were the first legislators to ever come through their door to examine the program. And the program had been around for 20 years, which was really quite a surprise to me. And it kind of speaks to how we kind of culturally have become. People that have a need for civil commitment that's been recognized by a court for civil commitment, they're considered probably dangerous to others. I think we go through the legal process, we put them in a hole somewhere and we shut the door and we kind of forget about them. And yet at the same time, from a procedural standpoint, it's important that we keep focus on the constitutional provisions that even those people still have, as well as the costs and whether or not there's a better way to reinvent the mousetrap. And I think the federal courts have given us a tap on the shoulder to suggest that maybe we can do better. And that's why we are here today. The one thing that I wanted to make mention of, and maybe you could expand on that, Commissioner, is do you think that this bill today is going to fix all of the problems? Or is this something that's going to continue to demand our attention in the next few years?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. May I first say, Senator Limmer, that I agree with your assessment and just what you said in your introductory comments. I do think that these are measured steps, but I think they are measured first steps, Senator. I do believe that this is a program that will require ongoing examination from the department, from the legislature. I would note that the task force, their main recommendations, as you know, Senator, are actually due in December of this year. So that while the recommendations of the task force dealing with, creating alternatives, and a few other things are coming to us now, that there will be a number of other recommendations coming at the end of the year. But I think that even with or without those recommendations, we need to look more closely at all parts of this program. But I believe that if you're going to start taking that hard look, this is a very good place to start.
Senator Dietz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank everybody that was on the task force and you too and Judge Rosenbaum for all your hard work. I think this is something that we do need to do. It's not an easy topic, but I worked for Hennepin County in the past, and so when I worked there, we were watching this in part because we have a lot of level three sex offenders, some of which we feel in Hennepin County that are dumped upon us. And so, and I've had this conversation with Kathy Sheeran and Senator Sheeran that I will be watching this closely because, again, I'm representing a portion of Hennepin County that feels we tend to get dumped on. I want to make sure that the whatever happens to these people is constitutionally okay for everybody involved, but then also to make sure my area, again, doesn't get unfair burden. I just want to put that on the record.
Thank you. Senator Sheeran, would you kind of step us through the bill a little bit, give us some highlights of what we ought to be...
Yes, I will. Yes, I will.
...watching for. Thank you.
Let me go through Article 1 first, which is the strict and intensive supervision and treatment and public education campaign. I got sure my materials are aligned with the
While you're doing that, Senator Sheeran.
This is what I was given here. Yes.
She's got the amendment in the original. Article 1 of the original bill stays the same.
This is the bifurcated.
Right.
This is what we just passed. Pontius, do I have the correct materials?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sheeran, yeah, you do. The if you have the first engrossment of the original bill or the bill, Article 1 is not affected by the amendment except for the first part that you see on lines 2 to 7 of the amendment, and then for Article 2, for that whole part, you go to the amendment.
Okay, let's begin again. Article 1, it addresses the strict and intensive treatment and supervision and public education campaign. So Section 1 in this portion of the bill, the Commissioner of Human Services is to ensure that there are an adequate number of facilities to provide strict and intensive supervision. Strict and intensive supervision is important for the individuals who are committed under Minnesota civil commitment statutes by the court. The facilities must meet public safety requirements as specified by the Commissioner of Human Services, by public safety and by corrections, and ensure the safety of the public while meeting the treatment needs of the civilly committed population. That's the combination, that's the important message here, is that we're meeting both public safety needs, but also that we make certain that we're meeting the treatment needs because we're dealing with a civil commitment, not an incarceration. Section 2 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop and provide education to judges and lawyers and examiners and others who will need to become familiar with the changes in this law. Section 3 is also an educational component, but it is directed at the public to help the public understand the class action lawsuit regarding the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program, the court's filings, and including the order that established the advisory task force and the work that is being produced by that task force. This public education has to be statewide, and it must help facilitate the public to understand the effort in place for the process of dealing with civilly committed sex offenders. Then Article 2 of the bill.
State amendment.
Members, that's the A3 amendment that we have adopted. While Senator Sheeran is getting the copy of the A3 amendment in front of her, I'm going to call the members' attention to the materials that are in your packet. We have in the packet a letter from Justice Magnuson dated December 3, 2012, in which he was transmitting the recommendations, the first report of the recommendations of the Sex Offender Civil Commitment Advisory Task Force, and there's a summary there. I also attached to that as a memorandum that identifies the conclusions and recommendations of that task force. We also have in our packets the evaluation report summary from the Office of the Legislative Auditor dealing with civil commitment of sex offenders, dated March of 2011. We have in the packet also a copy of the federal court order establishing the task force to make the evaluations and make the recommendations that were transmitted by Justice Magnuson. So for purposes of the committee and for the public that's watching this hearing, you understand that's the information that we have before us as we're evaluating this proposal.
Yeah, thank you very much, Senator Lance, for giving me a little time there. I did have the wrong materials in front of me, so they were not lining up with what I was talking about. So we now have Article 2, which is the A3 amendment. This amends the Sexually Dangerous Person Commitment Act by establishing a bifurcated hearing. You heard the commissioner talking about this, where the first phase of the hearing, the court determines whether or not a person is, in fact, meeting the criteria for being committed as a sexually dangerous person. And in the second phase of that bifurcated hearing, the court determines the appropriate placement consistent with the patient's treatment needs and requirements for public safety. Section 2 allows the court to commit a person to a strict and intensive supervision and treatment if the court finds that that's an appropriate placement. What we have heard over and over as we've reviewed the discussion of our process for dealing with civil commitment is that once a court determines that a person is appropriate for commitment, there was only one option in place for the person, and that was the most intensive treatment. So this is a process of asking the commissioner to continue on the good work she's already doing to expand options for the choice of the courts after a person is determined to be appropriate for civil commitment. Paragraph B finds that the court provides that the court finds, if the court finds that the strict and intensive supervision is appropriate, the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program prepares the plan, identifies the treatment and the services for the patient, and includes recommendations regarding the conditions under which the person is in strict and intensive treatment. Paragraph C provides that in order for this intensive treatment place for the placement, the patient is in the control and the custody of the Commissioner of Human Services for the provision of the treatment, for the services, and for the supervision under the Minnesota Sex Offenders Program. And the patient is subject to the conditions that are set by the court for the program. These conditions must ensure the safety of the public while the treatment needs of the patient are also addressed. In paragraph D, it allows the program to request an order from the court to revoke strict and intensive treatment if the program determines that a condition has been violated, those conditions set by the court and by the recommendations of the MSOP program. If any of those conditions have been violated or the patient is exhibiting a behavior that appears to be dangerous to themselves or the others, or they determined as a part of the program that it is in the best interest of the public, that the court could be directed could direct the law enforcement agencies to take the person into custody and then to transport the person to a more secure treatment facility. And then, of course, within 48 hours, the county attorney has to submit a statement showing probable cause for the detention and the submit a petition to revoke that treatment level that has been established. If the court determines there's been a violation, then the court shall revoke SIST, which we're calling SIST, strict and intensive supervision and treatment, and order the appropriate commitment placement. Paragraph E does not affect or replace any requirements related to the registration of predatory offenders. And then Section 3 requires the commissioner to appoint an examiner to conduct and re-examine the commitment of persons every 12 months to determine if the person has made sufficient progress. It should be every 24 months. And I think that there is maybe something in the language here that may need to be changed as well.
Senator Sharon, we're going to, just to make sure that we're able to follow you, which document are you working off of?
The A3.
A3 amendment? Okay, but the summary is drafted to the first engrossment, not to the amendment. So
I need to go back through what's here, maybe, and make sure.
Were you reading through the summary document?
I'm going through the summary of the bill, the summary statement. So let's go back and make sure that we're focused where. Perhaps what would be helpful is if I would articulate for you the differences between the delete all amendment and the underlying bill. Would that be helpful?
Okay.
What has changed here is that the special review board is eliminated, and references to the board are stricken throughout the bill. The Commissioner of Human Services is no longer a member of the judicial review panel. The new language clarifies access to records related to the bifurcated hearing, what is available in order for people to be able to determine the appropriate placement. The new bill examines the commitment individuals occur every 24 months instead of every 12 months. I'm sorry for the confusion here. The first bill that I was given that I was working off of had different language than what we intended, so I'm sorry for this confusion.
We just need to know that we've got the right section in front of us that you're referring to so we can read it while you're explaining.
Well, I'm going through it. That's right. I understand exactly. I think I'll have the commissioner begin to go through the bill for you to make sure that you understand it.
Okay. If we all have in front of us the A3 amendment for Article 2. Can we just take one common platform here and work off of that? Will that be okay? All right.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to start with Article 2. I think the Senator Sharon has already gone through Article 1.
Yes.
So looking at 4B and 4C, what this does is really eliminate the Special Review Board from their role with reviewing petitions from people who are committed to MSOP. That board will still continue its role for our MIND patients, but not for these patients. Instead, that role will be filled by the Special Review Board. This also provides that as Commissioner of Human Services, I'm not a party to the proceedings before the Judicial Review Board. So when you see the provisions on pass eligible status, that's just making the change from the Special Review Board to the Judicial Appeal Panel, and as I said, 4C eliminates the role the Special Review Board plays for this population. Looking at Section C, I'm at the bottom of page 2 and I'm on page 3. These are really the sections which set out the bifurcated proceeding which Senator Sharon described earlier. That has not, other than clarifying access to records related to the bifurcated hearing, that hasn't changed from the previous bill. And this is, as Senator Sharon said, making it clear that the court will first decide whether the individual meets the commitment criteria, and then if the individual meets the commitment criteria, holding a separate hearing about where the individual should be committed to, should that be to Moose Lake or to SIST, which is the strict and intensive supervision and treatment. Moving to section.
Commissioner Justin?
Yes.
On page 3, then lines 3.10 to 3.13, it specifies the standard of proof as clear and convincing evidence, and then if the court finds that, directs that the court shall commit the person to the commissioner. That's merely a codification of existing standards of proof. Is that correct?
That is the same standard of proof. Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you for clarifying that. Moving to Section 4, which is on page 4, these are the provisions that describe what that strict and intensive supervision and treatment will look like. describes that if the court decides to commit the individual to CIST, that they notify the program. The program, as the senator described earlier, prepares a plan that identifies the treatment and services for that patient, must present that plan to the court. The court has to approve that plan within 60 days. C explains that that plan will place the patient in the custody and control of the commissioner for treatment. D actually describes something that we think is very important to be added to this, and that is, as Senator Sharon described earlier, the ability for the program, if it believes an individual is exhibiting behavior that may be dangerous, then the program can go to the court just on an ex parte emergency basis and ask to be able to move that individual into a secure facility, whether that's a detention facility or perhaps back to the Moose Lake facility. We think that's very important to be able to do. And then there are obviously due process rights that follow that for the individual.
So, Commissioner, would that apply at no matter which particular facility or level of security at any particular treatment facility? They could be moved up to a more secure treatment facility under this provision, or if deemed necessary, returned to prison?
Mr. Chair, for any individual who is under in the CIST program, the Strict and Intensive Supervision and Treatment Program, no matter what facility they're in, then if they're exhibiting the behavior that may be dangerous to themselves or others, to immediately be able to take that person with this ex parte order and take them back to secure treatment. And then there obviously would be hearing and due process rights after that for the individual. This is actually similar to what we what we are doing, an amendment. Make sure I've got this right. And I think it was last year, perhaps the year before, we modified the law so that an individual on provisional discharge from MSOP generally, that this would be available. So if they're on provisional discharge and we see something that we think is dangerous behavior, truly inappropriate behavior, we're able to very quickly pull them back into a more secure environment.
Okay, so this is not about returning anyone to prison. This is about moving them within the treatment facilities from the most secure treatment facility that you have to perhaps some less secure programs that but also have the intense treatment capacities. I mean, not behind the razor wire, for example, but in other treatment programs that you've determined individuals might be appropriate for. But if they start acting out, making you nervous about their safety and others' safety, then you can move them back up within the sex offender treatment category into a more secure facility.
Mr. Chair, overall, that is the intent of this. The language does say that it would give them, we could direct law enforcement to take the individual to a DOC or county correctional facility, but all that is where can we get the person quickest into a secure environment. But the intent here is to be able to say, yes, if someone's in the CIST program, but we think we have concerns about safety, we can immediately, with that ex parte order from the court, pull them back and get them behind the razor wire, so to speak. Quickly.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 9 is...
biennial review.
It really relates to the biennial review. And this... provides, as I was discussing.
Which section are you in, Commissioner?
Actually, I'm looking at subdivision 9A, looking at the bottom of page 6. I think this is where the substantive changes are made.
Okay, so we're in section 5 of the bill.
Section 6.
And there's a lot of deletions on the top of section 5.
That relates to taking a special review.
And that, according to counsel, relates to taking the special review board out of the process. And then you go on to section 6, where it adds a subdivision 9A. Is that
correct.
Where you're at? Okay.
And this is directing...
What does 9A do?
Okay. What 9A is doing is directing the commissioner to appoint examiners so that every person who is in the program, in the sex offender treatment program, basically... will have an assessment from an independent assessor at least once every 24 months. And at the time of that examination, the individual can also retain or have an additional examiner appointed, which is similar to what happens in commitment proceedings today. Then going forward, it talks about the examiner providing, you know, the time they have to do the examination report, explains in B what the report must look at, the progress towards treatment goals, as well as risk and suitability for an alternative placement. This report will be made available to the judicial appeal panel, which is why we had some of the provisions taking the SRB, Special Review Board, out of this. At the time of the examination, I'm looking at D now, the executive director of the Sex Offender Treatment Program will also prepare a treatment progress report. So we'll have a report from the program and a report from this individual assessor.
So, Commissioner, the point of this provision is then that persons in the treatment program don't languish for an undetermined period of time, years even, without having an official examination and review by those supervising the program. Is that right?
That's correct, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
And do the reports then all go to the judicial appeal panel?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do.
So every 24 months, every person within this program is going to be reviewed by the independent judicial appeal panel to determine if they're making any progress and might be eligible for moving to a less secure environment, if you will, to a low.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think what the judges will have the information about the treatment for progress, about the risk, about whether or not they would be a candidate for a less restrictive environment, such as the CIST program. It doesn't mean that they have to immediately act on those, but at least we'll have judges reviewing that individual's progress or not in treatment and their risk status once every 24 months. And this is, I would say, kind of a best practice. This is what's happened in other states with similar programs.
Thank you. Commissioner, I want to address a technical error that counsel has identified while we're there. Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, on the A3 amendment on page 7, line 29, instead of annual, it should say biennial report. That was one we just missed.
All right, Senator Sharon.
Yes, we have to move change the language to biannual.
All right, Senator Sharon moves the change annual to biennial on line 7.29. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Commissioner, go ahead. Senator Limmer.
Commissioner, or perhaps Justice Magnuson, there's been reference that in the event that there was difficulty with an individual in civil commitment, that depending on where they are, they could be remanded to the Department of Corrections for another movement somewhere. If there was no criminal charge that initiated the patient's treatment, are we crossing over any legal or a constitutional line by mixing the treatment resources with that of the Department of Corrections? Does that cross any line as far as constitutional issues? Do you know?
I think, Senator Limmer, your question is if we in the process of the 20, if there's a process that allows those who are supervising this person to pull them from CIST into, because of certain behavior, danger to others or self-injury, that they can be taken by law enforcement into a correctional facility for a period of time until that review occurs. Are we crossing, you're asking if in the process of doing that we're crossing something, and I did not understand that portion.
Crossing any type of constitutional issue, changing it from a civil commitment staff handling to a Department of Corrections handling of that individual.
It's still.
Let me try. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, as
Justice
I understand,
Magnuson.
that provision of the statute is simply temporary custody by law enforcement to ensure protection of the individual and safety. I think that's consistent with how we treat general mental commitment. It's not that they will be charged with a crime. They will simply be secured until the civil procedure can move forward for correct placement.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
The security of the individual, however, is still under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Human Services, although they're asking for assistance by either law enforcement or corrections department. They're still under the jurisdiction of the care of the Commissioner of Health, Human Services.
Mr. Chair.
Justice Magnus.
Senator Limmer, I believe that's correct.
Right. Okay.
Commissioner, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Looking on page 13, which provides subdivision 2, section 17.
Commissioner, you just jumped a whole bunch of pages on us.
Okay.
We were on page 7, as I recall, or within section 6. And then,
okay.
So if you were done with that section, we should go to section 7 on page 8 of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I got caught up here.
Council is advising me that section 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16 are all technical changes relating to the change from the Special Review Board to the Judicial Appeal Panel. So I see why you skipped over all of that. But now we know why.
Thank you for your understanding,
right.
Mr. Chair. If I may turn to page 15, section 18, subdivision 2A, which I think is a substantive.
No, that's a little different.
Commissioner, I'm sorry. Would you jump back to section 17 so we don't skip over that? What does that do?
Certainly.
It's this here. Just this section.
The pertinent section here, Mr. Chair, is F at the top of page 15, and it's talking about. And it really relates to petitions which may be filed by clients for reduction in custody after these biennial assessments are done. And it's making clear that any person can oppose the petition and kind of sets out the timelines before the hearing when they need to, inform the panel and the opposing party whether or not they support or oppose the petition. And, Mr. Chair, I do apologize for my – I only saw a copy of this really at the beginning of this hearing, so I apologize for not – I knew the information, but I was not as familiar with how it was presented as I should have been.
Okay. No, I will note for the record that the document is actually dated today at 12:04 p.m. I know all the terms that are in it have been worked on for some time, but the actual creation of the document for us to track – is pretty new. I also note that the three of you are all quite familiar with all of this, the terms and everything you've been working on, and we are, most of us are probably seeing this for the first time, with the possible exception of Senator Limmer, who's been involved in the process for a long time. So
I'm looking at it the first time, too, Mr. Chair.
You'll need to catch us up a little bit just on the lingo.
Okay.
And we are seeing it for the – we've seen the language, but the –
order.
Organization of it is different in here, which is creating the impression that that you're getting.
Well, that's why I'm, as chair, trying to keep us on the
thank
same
thank you very much.
So
thank you.
So section 18.
Section 18, Mr. Chair, members, really addresses the right to petition for reductions in custody. So it makes clear that after the commissioner provides the reports to the judicial appeals panel, that the commissioner shall inform the person, so the individual is being reported upon, about their right to file a petition for reduction in custody. and that could be a petition for petitional discharge or to go from, like, Moose Lake, for an example, into assist programs. And that petition must be accompanied by argument, affidavits, exhibits, and the executive director of the MSOP could file a petition as well. It makes that point. If it's, the petition is timely filed, it sets out when the appeals panel needs and whether they need to set a hearing on the matter. And I'm looking at subdivision at C here at the bottom of page 15. And it makes clear that it's not like a hearing has to be done every 2 years, but a hearing must be conducted unless the panel determines that the petition and the accompanying documents fail to present a prima facie case. So the appeals panel will look at the documentation which's before them and say, is there a prima facie case or not? If there is, a hearing will be held. If there's not, it does not need to be held. But it does make clear, and I'm looking at the last part of the sentence on page 15, that every patient must have the opportunity to establish a prima facie case for an in-person hearing no less than once every 4 years. So to summarize, what the proposal is here is that there will be biennial, every other year's assessments of every client at MSOP, that there will be an independent assessor make that assessment, that the client will be able to ask for a second opinion, so to speak, that there will be a treatment. At the same time, the program will provide a treatment report on that client, that all of this will go to the Judicial Appeals Panel, that the client will be notified. The client can ask for an in-person hearing for reduction in custody. The appeals panel will look and say, is there a prima facie case with all this information? If there is, they'll hold the hearing. If not, they won't, but at least they'll have the information. But at least once every 4 years, an individual is entitled to an in-person hearing.
So, Commissioner, if in the opinion of the persons providing the treatment, the individual is making sufficient progress that they can be progressed to the next level, if you will, that I assume that can happen independently of these procedures before the judicial appeal now, right?
Mr. Chair, exactly. So progression in treatment from one part of treatment to the other, you know, is something that we, you know, would handle as we do today.
Okay, but this provides a backstop for review of the status. Now, so if the biannual review concludes that there's prima facie case for progress in treatment, you'll make the report to the judicial appeal panel, but you could still administratively progress the individual receiving treatment, right?
Mr. Chair, there are limits on what we can do just within the program. And, you know, I certainly probably have experts here with me here today that know more exactly what those are. But even today, that there are some things we can say, yes, you can progress between phase one and phase two of treatment. But on the other hand, today we couldn't say that someone could be provisionally discharged or even move outside the kind of razor wire to our community preparation services without going to the SRB. Here we'd have that go to the Judicial Appeals Panel. So there are some things that are within the power of the program, you know, as someone progresses the treatment to make decisions about. But there are a number of steps, including any really moving someone into a less secure environment, which today would first go to the SRB, but under this would go to the Judicial Appeals Panel.
Okay. And then at each stage, if the recommendation does not include a movement to the next phase or to a less secure environment, the individual receiving treatment would have the right to file their petition, the assistance of counsel in preparing that, and ask for their hearing, if you will, right? And that's what this section specifically provides.
Mr. Chair, this section specifically has a hearing right, a request for a hearing right, that is triggered by that biennial review. It also makes it clear that the treatment program can request that at any time.
Okay. Now, maybe just a collateral question, but my recollection is that each patient has a right to a court-appointed attorney for assistance in this process. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. And before we go any further, council has caught a couple of additional uses of the term annual that need to be changed to biennial on lines 15.20 and 15.21. Senator Sharon, will you make that motion?
I do.
All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
While we're on this page, I'd like to bring us back up to Section 17 on lines 9 and 10. There's a reference regarding the judicial appeal panel may appoint examiners. And this is the language I find rather, well, it's unusual, and may adjourn the hearing from time to time. I've never seen that in statute before, and I would just assume that a hearing board would be able to adjourn from time to time without putting it into law. Is there a reason why it's written this way?
I'm not able to provide a reason other than that it states what can be done.
Or
if it's why it's required.
How long the adjournment would last? Could it go for days or?
Apparently, I'm hearing that this is the same as current law.
Okay. So this language was pulled from current statute?
Okay.
We think you're right, but it's pulled from current language.
Okay. Just for leaving a few notes on the record, would the adjournment from the hearing, would it last? Is this a temporary adjournment, or could it be days or weeks? Do we know?
Commissioner Jessen.
Senator Sharon. Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, let me. The Supreme Court Appeals Panel today meets on certain days of the month. So if they don't finish one case during that day, then it gets pushed over often. So sometimes we will see hearings that I'm familiar with that are before them that have a couple of hearing dates in these complex cases, and it may be across several months. I think that answers your question. We actually, just so that you know, Senator, have worked with the courts to help fund a second Supreme Court Appeals panel so that we have more hearing dates available, because this has been a problem.
So, Mr. Chair, what we're really saying by including this language is we don't expect the court to do this all in one setting, and they were kind of recognizing their perhaps need to extend it over a bifurcated hearing process.
Commissioner Justin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think that's what the intent of this language has been.
All right.
All right. Commissioner Justin, anything further on Section 18?
No, Mr. Chair. I believe the next set of substantive changes really relate to the effective dates. Section 21, generally, sections relating to the elimination of the Special Review Board, the Judicial Appeal Panel changes, the petitions, and the review of placement are all effective under this bill on August 1st, 2013, which would be normal, but the biennial review section would be effective a year later. In August 2014, with half of the existing patients at MSOP being reviewed in that first year and the other half kind of beginning August 2014, with it made clear that all reviews must be performed by August 2016.
So the escape statute just covers a new cross-reference, right?
Is it clear that they're included in that intensive supervised treatment?
Okay. And Commissioner Jessen, I want to jump back to Section 20 for a moment. This is the felony escape statute that's in current law. And so basically anyone who attempts to escape from any of these facilities is committing a felony, short version of it. But the addition on line 17.1 incorporates into those facilities, the new facilities, that are contemplating being created here. Is that right?
Exactly, Mr. Chair. I apologize for skipping over that. It just declares that, as you stated, that our current felony escape statute applies to the individuals who are civilly committed to the CIST program.
So I think we have completed our review of the proposed bill before us. Is there any question or discussion from members of the committee relating to any of this? Commissioner Jessen, could you remind me again who will make up the judicial appeal panel?
Mr. Chair, my understanding, and I'll have people who correct me if I'm wrong, is these are judges or retired judges that, well, these are current judges, I believe, actually not retired judges, but current judges who are appointed by the Supreme Court.
Specifically for this purpose, is that
specifically
right?
For this purpose. Typically, they are judges that are, you know, trial court judges in other places, and that they're given this assignment in addition to that. We have a number of just exemplary judges like Judge Guerin and Judge Smith from Ramsey County who've been long-term members of our current Supreme Court Appeals panel.
Any other questions or discussion? Not seeing any.
Other testimony?
Is there any other testimony? Anyone else in the audience that wishes to provide testimony on Senate File 1014? Not seeing anyone coming forward. So Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1014 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
That's my motion.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you. All right. Senator Pappas, are you here? Senate File 778. Okay, not seeing Senator Pappas, the committee will take a brief recess until Senator Pappas arrives and will proceed with Senate File 778.